Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading.
Sometimes a book comes along which readers take to their hearts. When Nancy Revell wrote The Shipyard Girls, it was an instant success. By the time she'd finished book 12 in the series, it continuously made the Sunday Times bestseller list and cemented Nancy as one of Britain's best loved saga writers. Welcome, Nancy.
Oh, thank you for that lovely introduction.
You're so welcome. It's good. It's absolutely wonderful to have you on here because you and I go quite far back, don't we? In another life.
We do. And it's really funny because you were always a name for me because I was a freelancer sort of trundling around various sort of, you know, sink estates in England. you were always this sort of name really rather than a face because, of course, at that time there wasn't
Zoom and,
so it was really strange when I then sort of got to see you, you know, and that was more when we both went into writing, which was...
And just to explain for the readers, so years and years back, I was a commissioning editor on That's Life, the Women's Weekly magazine, and Nancy was one of our most regular freelancers, so always used to bring stories to us, and we'd have long chats on the phone, and you're so right, it was before... I don't think he even had a mobile phone back then. You know, you used to call into the office. So I feel like almost feels like another life. And I feel like you've straddled both parts of my life.
Yes.
Into writing books.
Yeah, same as. And I always felt it's really funny because I was talking about sort of the class system within publishing and journalism to a certain extent. And I felt when I was talking to you, I was dealing with somebody who was really sort of really down to earth. And I think that's why I kind of really took to you, you know, probably you witted on endlessly. Because as a freelancer, do you know what I mean? You're so in your own little world. So you get somebody with a bit of time that will actually talk to you.
But you're so right. There is a definite difference in the class system between journalism, as you and I both knew it, and the kind of stories that we were doing for the True Life magazines, and then this slightly more rarefied world of publishing, which is very different, isn't it? I had a question that I was going to ask you further down the line, but actually I'm going to jump right in with it now, because I always think it was one of the best training grounds working for Women's Weekly magazines. And one of the biggest things it taught me is that there is nothing so extraordinary as true life. What did it teach you?
God, well, funny enough, I gave a talk on this fairly early on, you know, once I started writing, because it felt so fundamental to what I was doing with fiction. You know, I could just go on and on and on, and I won't. I'll try and keep it very succinct, but it just taught me multiple things. And I always say to people who are interested in writing, especially young ones, I always say, just get into a job where you can write and you can earn money from it, like journalism or something, because it will teach you so much about the language. It'll teach you so much about how people speak and how they look and their mannerisms. And it will give you such a broad, you know, a broad insight into all areas of society, you know, especially if you are sort of a reporter as such. So one minute you're sort of chasing a celebrity and the next minute, you know, you're knocking on the door of a paedophile or something. So, you know, you just have this wealth of stuff. So as the years go on, which is why I'm always really glad that I didn't write as a younger person within fiction, you come as a slightly older person with this great tank.
Oh, God, you're so right. You're so right. I don't think that you could write the sorts of books that we have written, aka saga, if you hadn't had that background and that enormous wealth of knowledge and life experience from going out and sitting with people, often at their most traumatic, vulnerable moments. Yes. Like you and I they used to call it the death knock, didn't they?
You'd go and
arrive on someone's house. You never knew what kind of reception you were going to get.
Yeah.
And you had to just sell yourself on the doorstep and to get into the house and get the story.
And seeing that kind of, it's really interesting because you do forget how many times you did that. I was always pleased that I maintained that empathy and I didn't become too hardened by it. And I think that's done me well later on because, you know, I'm so empathetic as a person generally. You know, I did so many, never got hardened to it. And I'm really thankful for that. And I do use that an awful lot within my writing. So when I write a character, there's always some elements of myself, other people that I've had experience with that is true. So in a way, although it's fiction, I always feel like it is non-fiction as well, because everything I write is true, or I have experienced or somebody else has experienced.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think you never became hardened to it. In fact, most female journalists that I know have never become hardened to the issues that you're going. And actually, I feel personally, my well of empathy gets bigger as I get older, and I think that's one of the plus points of aging, yes, is that you become more empathetic and more, yes, open to compassion and understanding. And I think if you can channel all of that into your characters and, yes, understanding that the issues that they're going through, be that grief or betrayal or, yeah, trauma, your writing is the richer for it. So, mm, you're right, I think, when you go out and give those talks and say to people, you know, I think it was such a great training ground, wasn't it, writing for True Life Features, yes, because you had 1,500 words. Yeah. I always try to treat it like a small book with a beginning and a middle and an end.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
it's quite a good training exercise, yes, actually, isn't it? If you're, yes, wanting to write novels, it condense your story.
Yeah, it's a bit like a template in a way, because like I always remember when I worked on one of the agencies, which, as you know, quite sort of hardcore and introduce you to the sort of the tabloid world. And I started writing features, so I moved from writing very short, sort of snappy news articles to features. And she always said to me, you've got to draw your reader in immediately within those first couple of sentences. And we talked a lot about beginning and endings within, you know, compiling that feature. And I think that kind of applies very much to books as well. It's like you say, it's, yeah, like a minuscule book.
Absolutely. And it's about getting that voice, isn't it? And that characterization through dialogue, which is a really tricky thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think working on those... working on those True Life magazines gave us that understanding of the impact of dialogue,
yeah,
particularly, you know, show, yeah, don't tell, as they say, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And because you were forced to write, especially with the feature writing, and you were writing it in that kind of style with people like That's Life and Take a Break, you were writing in a fictionalized way. So that also then you, yeah, take that step nearer to writing novels through writing those features, I think.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It kind of plays in. There's so much crossover, and you would never think it when you see those magazines on the newsstands, yeah, and, you know, Chat and Pick Me Up, and they're quite, yeah, garish, and they've got screamy, shouty headlines.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of would-be novelists would recoil if they saw that. But actually, writing those sorts of stories, and not just writing them, but going out and finding them and winning people over to trust you enough to tell their story.
Yes.
These, yeah, are hard skills to learn.
Yeah. And also I always felt a real duty to sort of replicate that person's story. So and I used to always give them read backs, which I know you did as well. Yeah. Just, not everybody does that. And, you know, because I so wanted it to be as accurate as possible, really. Which kind of brings us to the research that we've had to do, mm, with writing historical, you know, is really getting stuff right and getting it accurate, because that was a fundamental of journalism, wasn't,
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because if you didn't, you'd be getting the angry phone call on a Thursday morning when the magazine came out with people threatening to sue you and so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, or you know, getting things through the lawyers as well, because I'm sure, you know, we always had a band, yeah, of lawyers that had to sort of sanction stuff. So when I wrote the first book in particular, I was probably a bit too overcautious, and I was thinking, oh, you know, if I say this about the nuns, because I had one of the, oh, you know, this, but and I sort of backed it up with all these previous court, yeah, reports on, yeah, and I didn't care, you know.
Yeah, I know. You probably came at it with a journalistic head. I did exactly the same when my first, yeah, book came out. I panicked so much. I was like, would my research stand up, and, you know, yeah, and law, and then actually you have to take a step back and go, okay, this is fiction, this, yeah, isn't the same,
yeah,
so it's about, yeah, compartmentalizing the two sides of your, you know, being a journalist and being a fiction writer.
Yeah, yeah, it is, it's a real mesh. Yeah, and you're right, you have to get that balance right, you know, of keep telling yourself, no, okay, stop doing your research now and just, yeah, get on with writing a really good story.
Yeah, that's it, because the story, and I've come to learn this, and this has been a hard one lesson, I think, that the story must stand above all, and,
yes,
that the research is there to prop it up and complement it and support it, but you've got to have a really powerful story to sweep the reader away. They're,
yeah,
not going to really care about your research and your statistics and your,
yeah,
and whether it supports. It's not an article, it's a vehicle of escape, isn't it?
It is, definitely. And every book that I write, I, you know, I always end up sort of cutting out loads of the research that I've done, and it hurts me to do it. It's just like, no. And every time I go, okay, try and sort of take a back, you know, don't do quite so much research, but it's really hard not to, especially when, you know, history's so exciting, isn't it? And,
yeah,
you totally get into certain things.
I think you're exactly like me. I over research all the time, and I plow it in and I ladle it on. And then when you step back and you think, it's really painful. It's like the removal of a limb, but you have to take that stuff out because it's getting in the way of the story.
Yeah, it's slowing it down. Yeah, exactly. And I never wanted to be one of those writers who, I never wanted to be a sort of literary writer or anything where it's really heavy and wordy and descriptive. You know, I've always loved, fast moving books where I don't have to think, oh God, what does that word mean? You know,
it's funny, isn't it? Because that concept of being a literary writer, I've never pegged myself as such. I couldn't because I'm not. And I think, a lot of writers aspire to be the Waterstones / literary writer. But to do so is to demean this enormous genre of books that means so much to the majority of women living in this country. So this issue of Saga, which is often looked down upon and people are a bit sniffy towards it. And yet they sell by the millions. Yeah. Women connect to them and they love them.
Yes.
And especially your book. So this was my original first question, actually, to start with. So for those that haven't discovered The Shipyard Girls, which were phenomenally popular, tell us a bit about your series. So where the books are set and the inspiration behind it.
The books are set in World War II, so from 1940 to the end of the war. So book one begins just when the so-called sort of phony war, which again, I didn't even know what that meant, before I started researching. So when the bombs first started to drop, that's when I started the first book. And the last book ends on V-Day. And it's basically about this sort of group of women that do their war work in the shipyards in Sunderland. I think I chose that again, we were talking about journalistic things. When I was looking at all the other books that are sort of, in this genre, we're taught, aren't we, as journalists, the story is only sort of worth printing if it's unusual, if it's different. Nobody wants to just read about what they know. So I kind of applied that with the saga. And it was kind of by chance, actually, that I kind of came across that women work there, because obviously I didn't know it myself, even though I'd been brought up in Sunderland, even though obviously, every day I saw the shipyards, which were very much working at that time in the 80s before they were all closed. And my mum's family had all been shipyard workers. I didn't know that there was women shipyard workers. And it was only when I came across this sort of lone article, and in a way I have my husband to thank for this, because we were talking about it. And he said to me, well, didn't women work, his husband's Southern, didn't women work in the shipyards? And my initial reaction was just like, no, we're talking about the North, we're talking about in the 1940s, of course women. And I was just like, oh my God, I found this article. I just kind of stabbed it into Google and there was this one lone article. And I was just like, it was just like that moment where you suddenly get really excited. Oh. And it was just like, oh my God, they did. These women work in the shipyards. I've never known this before, and if I don't know, I bet you loads of other people doing more research couldn't find hardly anything written about them. And this lone article was a very small article. It was a local article for Northeast BBC. And it was only very short, so only like 150 words. And I just thought, okay, I'm inspired by two things. One, that these women have never been given any kind of, appreciation of what they did. They've never been given any kind of publicity or retrospective sort of insight into their work. And I felt really passionate about that. And I felt like, oh God, this is just so typical of our sort of misogynistic society. They've never been given a revered for what they did. And this was, I saw shipyards at the time. Who would want to work there? Really hardcore. Forget the weather. Do you know what I mean? I mean, the weather up north is different. It's harsh. It's on the northeast coastline. You are within spitting distance of the North Sea, and to be an outdoor worker as well. So all of these things sort of really inspired me. And then what really grabbed me was just like, wow, this is so different. This is what I'm going to focus on with this group of women. They're all going to be working in this shipyard. And that's where it started from. So I wrote this sort of a little sort of summary for the publishers at the time who were looking at lots of other people. And it was just sort of, I'll give it a go. And then they sort of leaped on it, which on hindsight, I can kind of see why, because they hadn't had, a saga that focused on women, especially women who sort of, worked in such a labour, male-orientated industry. So I can see why. So it was a sort of a dual, the excitement that I felt, that sort of golden nugget, I found this golden nugget moment, what was it twofold? It was this sort of that sort of feminist part of me saying, my God, you know, these women need to be appreciated. And the other storytelling part of me saying, wow, what great material.
Yeah, I love that. I really love that, Nancy, that you found this 150-word story and it set a fire within you, didn't it? Because you knew that this hadn't been covered. And I think what I find amazing about these women as well, like you say, they're in, you know, in apocalyptic weather and they're working on hard, brutal, exhausting conditions. And then they're going home and looking after children and doing the domestic, so they're doing their second job.
Yeah.
So I always find that amazing.
I know. And I did as well. And that's, I suppose, you know, the journalistic thing where I think what you do learn is you really learn to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, because I think that's the only way that you can replicate their true life stories and do justice to them. So in a way, you sort of carry that across. And I know you've done that as well. You carry that across so that you walk in your character's shoes. You know, you literally go there in your mind and you feel that biting, you know, cold, and you walk around in their hobnail boots, you pull on their oversized overalls, you hold that heavy welding mask, you know, and yeah, it's fascinating. And then, like you say, then you think, hang on a minute, okay, so the buzzer goes, the klaxon goes, they're all sort of squashing their way through the big gates to get home. And, you know, they don't just grab a meal from wherever and bang it in the microwave. You know, they go home and they have to cook that meal, they have to do that laundry, they will probably have children, and on top of it all, they will probably have male members of their family that they're absolutely worried sick about because they're on the front line somewhere, or they're dealing with bereavement, you know. So it's just,
yeah, and to say nothing of the bombs probably dropping down on them as well. So it's sort of, you know, they're fighting a war on all fronts.
Yeah, it was sort of getting, I mean, yeah, it sort of goes from one to this, like, it's dominant. Oh my God, and there's that, and there's that. And especially with the shipyards, you see, with Sunderland, what was so unusual was that because all the shipyards lined the River Weir, obviously before the war, you know, obviously all the workers there, with the cottages were built, small terraced houses were built all around, you know, the north and the south side of the river, so that obviously they could just walk to work, you know, or cross the river and go to work. So then, you know, when the bombs started to drop, you know, they were meant for the shipyards, because obviously they were bombing industry, but they weren't that accurate. And 9 times out of 10, they were actually hitting, you know, residential areas.
Yeah, I mean, and it's so fascinating listening to you talk about it, Nancy, and your passion for it. And there's so much talk, especially in those literary circles that we referred to earlier, of this sort of feminist manifesto. Well, my God, if you want to read a strong feminist story, you couldn't go far, you know, you won't go far wrong if you read this series of books, because that will give you more understanding about women's contribution in the 20th century than any literary book that you could care to pick up.
Yeah, it is interesting because, and then what I found kind of heartbreaking was when I came to the end, it was just like, well, I can't carry on their stories because, you know, history, it is written in the history books, it is fact that most of them went back and kind of did a backward step with regards, you know, women's right and everything, because they kind of went back into being homemakers. Not that there's anything wrong with that at all, but it was, they didn't really have that choice. They didn't have that choice to stay on because the men were coming back and they were taking back their jobs, which was totally understandable. But the women all of a sudden found themselves in this predicament where they had for 5 years been, you know, doing all these things that we've just talked about, and then were suddenly back in the scenario where they were homekeepers, you know, wives and mothers. And that's what fired me on to do going into the 1950s. I then found that really interesting to take that step forward and take one of the girls in particular who worked in the shipyards, who was also very working class and had married somebody who was almost aristocratic, you know, he was that sort of upper class, and take her into the 1950s. And that was then fascinating again, because you're looking at how women then developed in the 50s, which was, I found, fascinating.
Yeah, and I love that you've done that, because you had this, I mean, you wrote 12 books back to back, which, you know, my God, I don't know how you did it, Nancy, because honestly, I know the effort and the work and the production that goes into these. So you were just on a pretty punishing schedule, wasn't it? But before we get into actually the next book, I just wanted to sort of ask you, because it's one thing finding that golden nugget, isn't it? It's finding that untold story that, you know, the journalist in you thinks, yes, I've done it, I found that untold story, is quite another writing strong female characters that in your case really left an indelible mark in your readers' hearts. You created this cast of characters that people absolutely fell in love with, which explains why people went out and bought the book as soon as it hit the newsstands and you made those Sunday Times bestseller lists. And I think it's because you created this cast of women who people felt they intimately knew. How did you do it? How did you create such well-drawn, sort of fully fleshed out characters?
Yeah, that's a lovely compliment for you to say that as well. And that is lovely. But I think it's because I love people. I love, you know, humans. And I find them endlessly fascinating, really. It's really funny when you're talking that there's this image comes in mind. And I was in Waterstones doing the book signing, as you do on publication day or thereabouts. And in that particular book, the publishers had put this little quiz at the back, which character are you? And you did this little sort of quiz to say which one you were.
Which was great
because my editor did it, I did it. And, you know, she was like, oh, she's... And so when everyone was coming up and I was having a little chat to them, I said, what have you done? Have you done the quiz? What character are you? And it was really interesting that, you know, every one of them related to, felt very strongly drawn to one particular character. And I must admit, a lot of them were very drawn to Gloria, who is your older character. And I was really pleased with that because obviously she's a bit older than me. The fact that they felt so sort of akin to her was wonderful to hear.
That's so interesting that really then you've got to create characters that people not only enjoy reading but relate to. They walk a bit in their shoes and understand them and think, well, who would I have been? How would I have reacted in war? It gives you a safe space to explore.
Yes.
Second World War, but through a distance, doesn't it?
Definitely. And also... something I was thinking of the other day, because I always write a dear reader, don't I, at the back of my books. And I was thinking, I was writing a dear reader in this new book, and I was like, and I just thought, do you know what? We don't really change. The outer casing changes, but the kernel doesn't really. And that's what we're like, and that's why people relate to them. So I think Shipyard Girls could have been written in 1800 or 1960 or nowadays, but I think it's the characters... are timeless in a way, because all of our life is kind of timeless in that way, isn't it? The way we feel, the way we think, the things that we have to go through in life is pretty much the same. It doesn't, we all have to deal with bereavement and illness and sadness and love, whether we were in the 1800s or now or war.
You're so right. I think it could have been set in any century, really, doesn't it? And I think that's why it explains the popularity of saga and historical fiction, is that it gives you that way of exploring the past.
Yeah.
And also the resonance of that between that and the sort of current issues that we see. I think it's that gives you that sense of, and so too, this your past. I think we get reassurance from looking at women and how they've faced extraordinary and overcome adversity and thrived. It makes you, we can draw courage, our own personal courage, from that, perhaps.
Yes, I have quite a lot of communication with my readers, and they're just wonderful, and they message me and everything, and so I get to see how they feel about stuff, and I do also think what they loved was the sense of dysfunctional family that the women had, you know.
Let's be honest, who doesn't have a dysfunctional family?
Yeah, exactly. And they kind of came together, and they were all really different, but they got on and they accepted each other and they helped each other. I kind of felt with some of the younger characters also, which I loved writing, like Angie and Dorothy, you know, there's so many Angie and Dorothy's about now, isn't there? They're sort of slightly ditzy, you know, they just want to have fun. Yeah, so they were all, I enjoyed writing them all in a way. Yeah. And you know, Rosie, the one who really has been through quite serious trauma, but is an incredibly strong, and she has this sort of lioness quality about her that, you know, she's going to survive for the sake of her younger sibling.
And what a privilege as well, as you're talking, to have that connection and with your readers, because, you know, that is obviously the best part of the job, isn't it? When you get the email through or you get a letter from somebody saying, this book, you know, it really struck me, and people kind of relate to it and connect to it. It's wonderful that you've got that connection, because it's the readers that put you there, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah, definitely.
You seem to have a real loyal army of readers.
Oh, that's really nice. I know. I feel like I've got this, like, huge extended family. It is incredible. And especially when I have signings and one in particular, which, you know, God, you know, I felt incredibly emotional about, because this lovely woman called Kath, came up to me. It must have been about on the third book, and she sort of gave me this beautiful bouquet of flowers. And I was just like, oh my gosh, you know. And I was like, thank you, but, you know, why, sort of thing, you know. And, you know, I was kind of thankful for them for buying the book and liking it, you know. And she just said, your books gave me such solace during the months following my husband's death. She said it just really, really helped me through, and I was just will be forever thankful. And it, you know, and it was just wow. That was just the most incredible, hugest compliment I think I could ever have been given.
That's amazing. And I've got a real sense of you every time you come to your computer to write the next book, that this sort of that you're surrounded by the readers that you are writing for, and that each book they're sort of swelling in their ranks, and you've got this army of readers behind you. So by the time Book 12 came out. Were you surprised by the book success?
Oh, God, like massively. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Hugely.
I mean, because it's the dream, isn't it, to make the Sunday Times bestseller list. And you've been on it how many times now?
Yeah, I know.
A lot.
I know, loads. And I swear to God, this is true, and how ignorant and because obviously I'd been immersed in the whole journalistic world. So for me, to be honest with you, I hadn't even read that many books before I started writing The Shipyard Girls, because you know, your reading is all newspapers, magazines, you're watching Sky all the time, you know, and by the time you fall into bed, you know, you could maybe read a couple of pages of your latest book and that's it. So all of a sudden I was sort of plunged into this publishing world and writing this book. And I was just so obsessed with actually being able to get to the end of this book, because I didn't know how it was going to end. And I was really terrified that I wouldn't be able, you know, creating these characters. And they were like, great, you know, just, yeah, we want you to write this book. We want you to write 6. And they're just like, okay, well, let's just do the first one first. Let me just see if I can do one. And I was just so obsessed with, like, getting to a good ending. And I didn't know if I could. And I was just, you know, anxious and terrified, and I got to the end of it. But I didn't really know anything about the publishing world. And I think it was the fourth book. She rang me up and she went, my publisher, my editor, she said, oh, I'm so excited. And I remember standing, because I'd moved up to Sunderland by this stage. And I remember standing in my office, and I was sort of looking out, and I can actually see, almost see the North Sea and almost where the shipyard used to be. She said, I can't remember her exact words, but it was just like, you've made this list, you know. And I was like, oh, that's really good. Yeah. And then there was this sort of pause, and she could tell, obviously, I had no, and I said, oh, sorry, I don't really know what you mean. And she said, she's put on the town's bestsellers list. And I said, okay, can you just explain that? And she took me through what a big thing it was. Da, 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 da. And then obviously, you know, I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. And it was just really surreal. And then obviously I put the phone down and ran downstairs and said to him, I've made the Sunday Times of services. And he looks at me blankly, you know.
He didn't know what.
And then it sort of slowly dawned on me what a massive thing this was. So overjoyed at that stage. A, they wanted me to continue writing the books, and B, people were really enjoying them.
Yeah, oh, that's amazing. I love that you didn't really know the significance of the Sunday Times bestsellers. But I get the impression it must have been like a sort of tornado in a way that kind of came and sucked you up, and then you were in that whirlwind of writing, research, promoting, and that's quite a cycle, you know, to follow through. And you did it for 12 books. How did you do that? How did you juggle that? Was it lots of caffeine and not much sleep, or how did you weather that?
Well, it's funny actually, because I think the other reason that I was sort of a bit unaware of life outside writing the book, I was sort of unaware of anything to do with publishing, I think, because I just thought, you talk about compartmentalizing, and I think that's what I did. I just thought, look, forget about agents, forget about publishers, forget about the bookseller and all these trade things that are talking about writers, just write. But during all of that, I moved from Oxford up to Sunderland in order to write the books. So I got commissioned to write in July 2015, and I went for a walk with husband and said, I feel like I need to, if I'm going to do this really well, and I'm going to do it to the best of my ability, I feel like I have to be up north when I write them. Because I never thought I'd get commissioned for it. So I kind of just did it a little bit sort of, you know, oh yeah, I have to be set up in Sunderland, and, you know, because that's where I come from. And, you know, no books I've ever written about Sunderland. I felt really passionate about a book being set in Sunderland, but I didn't think they would commission me to write a book. So it was all a bit sort of, you know, up in the clouds, airy fairy. And all of a sudden they're like, yes, we want you to write 6. I said, okay, I have to go up there because I'd been away for so long. I needed to hear the dialect. I needed to hear the language. I needed to feel that weather. You know, I needed to walk along the beach again. I needed to look where the shipyards were. So thank God, husband said, okay. And we had only just moved. We'd only just moved literally a few months before. So I wrote the start of the Shipyard Girls in a little room that was overlooking the car park of Co-op in Oxford with books still, with boxes still around me. So we bought a house up in Sunderland. Yeah, we moved just before the Christmas. So within that 6 months. So it was complete and utter madness. Once I was there, everything else just took back seat. But I will say, I do think I was only able to do this because I don't have children. I honestly believe if I had children, I just wouldn't have been able to put that time and intensity into it.
You think? That's interesting.
Yeah.
So much to unpack in that. I'm amazed and impressed that you actually moved house to be where your characters lived. You know, you talk about authenticity and going the extra mile. That really is. You packed up your life and moved back up north. Do you think if you'd stayed in Oxford, the books would have been the same?
You know what? I don't know. All I remember is, I remember going into the publishing company and my editor and publishing director at that time was, and she's very well known in the industry now, I realise, Jenny Jerez. Jerez, I never pronounce her name properly, I don't think, but anyway, she's lovely. She's with Book of Tour now. And I remember that slightly aghast look on her face when I was sort of sat there and all the team there and telling me how they, you know, how the book was going to progress and introduce me to sort of marketing and everything. And I sort of said, "Hi, sorry, I'm moving back up there." And I could see her thinking, "Oh my God, we've just this. And she went, "Oh, you don't feel like you have to do that." And I could tell she was sort of gassed, you know, I was like, doing this outrageous thing of actually moving up there. And I could just see everything in her face, you know, that she was thinking. And I said, "Oh, don't worry, you know, if they're not a success, they're not a success, but I'm going to do it because I think this is the only way to do it. This is the only way to do
it." You fully committed to it, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, good for you because and it was absolutely paid off in that way, didn't it? Because I think people could feel that through your writing, that commitment and that passion for those women.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's little things. I do think it's quite, I must admit, I do feel it's quite important to be in the place that you write about generally, even if it's just for a certain amount of time, because it was like little things I'd forgotten about, like the seagulls. Do you know, you're always hearing the seagulls around you there. Now, I wouldn't have remembered that being down here. And the weather, I know I keep going on about it, but my God, you do forget how how it affects you. So all those little sort of details.
Yeah, I agree. It's those little visceral things that you, if you're not in a place, and that's the struggle, isn't it? When you can't move to a place. Like I've just finished a book set in Jersey. And there were many a time I longed to move to Jersey, which is completely impractical. So I went there as many times as I could because you need to walk the streets.
Yes.
You need to feel, smell the aroma, the distinct details that make up an area.
Yes.
You've got to like almost cloak it around you, haven't you? Like a thick woolen coat and absorb that details.
Yes.
But that explains so much to me about how you got into the psyche of that area and how you came to write it so authentically. But you said an interesting thing earlier about just write those two words, you know, that you just got up every morning, you came to your desk and you just sat down and wrote. That's actually a lot harder than it sounds.
It is.
What was it spurring you on? You know, what was your routine? Talk me what you did.
Well, first of all, fear originally spurred me on.
Fear is a great driver.
Oh,
the deadline.
Because also, you know, I'd basically left journalism knowing, you know, journalists do, you know, and commissioning editors have short memories to a certain extent, don't they?
So
when you're out of the scene for a while, it's hard to get back in. So I was sort of fearful that I had left what, you know, my bread and butter, as it were. I mean, you know, I was lucky in the fact that I did stipulate to the publishers, which is, again, something I always say to people when I do talks to the youngsters, is you must show your value and say you must at least pay me enough money so that I can live. So luckily with that first deal, I was given enough money just about to sort of get by on. But it was obviously it was a drop from what I'd been earning as a freelance journalist. So kind of fear was driving me on of survival, which is really nice. That's gone a little bit more. It's a lot more enjoyable now. And, you know, now it's totally a different sort of vibe. But back then it was kind of it was fear. It was it was inspiration, it was excitement, kind of loads of things that kind of all balled into one that I think just had me there bashing stuff out on the computer.
And I think sometimes you can overthink it, can't you? You just need to sit down, write one word, write another word. And to begin with, I don't know how you feel, but when I first, it was probably different for you actually because you're writing the same characters. But whilst you're getting to know your characters, I always feel like it's going to a party and making small talk with people you don't really know. You're sort of dancing around a bit, trying to, and it's not until you just you have to just show up every day and write words and get to know your characters, and then they start behaving in ways that are extraordinary, and they do things that take you by surprise. So it takes a while, but there is no easy shortcut to that, is there? It's just a case of turning up to the page and writing words and living with these characters in your head, I suppose.
Exactly, and putting that time in, definitely. Mm-hmm. And that is so much of it. The irony is, is that you only get to know those characters at the end of the book when you finish writing.
Yeah. Yes.
Then you kind of go back and go, okay, I really know you now. And kind of, especially this recent book, I've kind of done it more because I've had a bit more time. But I sort of wrote this book and then I sort of went away for a couple of weeks and I came back and was like, right, I really know you, the characters now. And I sort of tore it up a little bit and kind of rewrote it because I knew them.
Oh, that's interesting. So when you and I last spoke, I think you just finished book 12 and you were pretty exhausted, I think it's fair to say. And you were like, I need a break. And you were going to go off and write something in a very different genre, which you have indeed done. But now you've come back to the Shipyard Girl. So tell us a bit. I know we touched on it earlier, but tell us a bit more about the Widow's Choice.
Yeah, sometimes I suppose it's just, sometimes you just need that break, don't you, in life generally with stuff. And I suppose because I had been so driven by crime in the journalism, I'd sort of gone from black to white. And then I sort of came at the end of book 12 and I thought, I think maybe I had a bit of a hankering for that sort of crime. So I kind of indulged that. And that was great. And it was also really another learning process because I was writing in a different genre. So it was a slightly different way. And I realised when I got to the end of it, I missed something. There was something I missed. And I know what it is now. What I really missed was that sort of depth. That sort of really getting to know a character, those nuances, which you don't necessarily get when you're writing something like crime, because it's so much, it's kind of more story, isn't it? And I miss the sort of the detail. There was something I felt that I missed, and it's really hard to explain what it was, but this idea came to me having had this sort of, rest. And I was thinking, my mind sort of swung back. And I think it's also, a lot of it's my readers' fault, I think, because they kept sort of messaging me saying, oh, what's going to happen to them? What do you reckon? And I think maybe they were playing on my mind a little bit. And I was thinking, I wonder what they would do. And some of them are sort of, some of the main characters sort of knew. And I kept coming back to Angie, who is one of the sort of, she's one of the main characters, but not one of the main characters. Oh, I don't want to give too much away about the plot, but basically, I just started thinking about her, and I was thinking, God, she's gonna be this working class background. You know, she was the most sort of working class character in the book, probably, maybe it's Gloria. And I really loved Angie because she. I think went through quite a big learning curve during the Shipyard Girls. And then, she met this guy who was totally not from her world and fell in love. And but he just so happened to be extremely rich. But they gelled and it was this real sort of feel of a genuine love that had sort of surpassed those boundaries of class and education. And I thought, God, I wonder how they would then manage, because she'd always been in her world. But, she had to leave the Shipyard Girls and she was married and she was going to go and live with, her siblings as well as Quentin in the manor, Cuthford Manor in Darlington. So she was even going to a different area of the Northeast. So it was full of this. What inspired me in a way was that, so I was going from, this is the seaside, the sea and that kind of industry, to countryside, but still within the Northeast, and to a place that was incredibly rich. So it was a complete dichotomy of the shipyard girls, but still taking one of the characters.
And also,
so that just sort of excited me. I was just like,
yeah. God, so you got the same, I was just thinking you got the same spark of passion that when you realized that you discovered this story first time around. And I love the jeopardy of that. I love that you've taken this, you know, brassy working class girl who's, you know, weathered the storms and the war and the blitz and the shipyards and thrown her into, you know, talk about dichotomy, like you say, and the 1950s and, you know, domesticity and a different class. I mean, there's so much to overcome there, isn't there? So that's a great, I suppose every story needs jeopardy, doesn't it? But you've thrown her right in there. There's so much to dismantle for her there.
And then, and I don't know whether I can say this, but you can always edit it out. But and it kind of is given away in the publicity for the new book, sort of gives it away. But then to really create problems, at the beginning of the book starts and her husband has an accident and he dies. So she has been plunged into this world that is, you know, so unlike what she has been brought up to. And yeah, she all of a sudden finds herself in charge of this manor on this huge estate with her four siblings. So that there's this great sort of sense of sort of belonging as well. So all of a sudden she just doesn't feel like she belongs anymore. And, you know, there's lots of other things that come into it, because the other thing I find interesting about the research was that a lot of the stately homes and the manors were requisitioned during the war. And obviously a lot of them were, and then there was these great taxes. So all of a sudden, financially, although she's living in this great place, there's lots of other sort of things, challenges and hardships coming her way that are to do with what was happening at that time.
Yeah, I bet, not least a leaky roof and probably all the other myriad issues.
Well, yeah, because at that time, and again, you know, this kind of shows the prevalence of what's happening now in Parliament. We discussed about, you know, inheritance tax. And at that time, inheritance tax for people like the so-called rich was 85%. So when somebody died, the government took 85% of their estate. Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, serious problems. So, and this is, I think, another example of how reality drives a plot. So that the idea of a plot comes through your head, but then you find something like that out, which is shied, and I was just like, oh, wow, so this is something else, you know, that she's going to have to deal with. Not just that he's dying, she has to give away 85% of what she's...
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. And what I love most about this, the whole thing of you coming back and having written this sequel, is the fact that it's in the best possible tradition of books and reading, and that relationship between the author and the readers, because the readers have demanded it of you. They've always dragged you out of your little links, you know, out of your garden and back behind your desk. They asked it for you, and that is actually how it should be, you know.
The
relationship between the reader and the author,
it's
so unique that they have brought this book into being, which is quite remarkable, really. It's not publisher driven, there's nothing fake about it.
You're so right. And I hadn't sort of seen that before, because it's been such a gradual process of, you know, sort of being taken back by this love and gradually, you know, this readership and all these people. And they've just kind of become a part of it. So I don't kind of see that. But yes, you're right. That's exactly kind of what happened.
Otherwise, you'd still be tinkering in your garden right now. In many ways, gardening is a little bit like writing, isn't it? Because you toil away, you put things into the ground that you don't see immediately, and you have to sort of step back and wait. And then hopefully in 9 months, something blossoms, which in your case, it really did.
My book writing, thank God, is much better than my ability to grow things, I have to say. I think what I enjoy, there's two things which I do outside writing, and that's swimming and gardening now. And I think it's because, and that's why I get some of my best ideas, because I think something happens when I'm swimming or gardening. And I think it's like that sort of percolation that goes on in the brain. And that's when I get some of my best ideas for storylines and twists and turns. And then I kind of rush back to the car and then rush home and write it down before I forget.
Do you know, one of the things I love most about doing this podcast, apart from speaking to really lovely women like yourself, is actually you begin to see themes emerging. Because as you're saying that, it reminds me of an interview I did with Natasha Lester, who was talking about how every morning she runs. And at first she thought, I shouldn't really be doing this, it's a bit indulgent. And then she began to realise that it's as crucial to her routine as research, because it's while she's running and in that meditative state that ideas percolate and things happen subconsciously that perhaps you're not even aware of. And then she gets home and she powers it all down. So if anyone's listening to this and wanting to establish themselves as a writer. You could do a lot worse and build those things that seem a bit self-indulgent. But for me, it's walking. I love walking the dogs each morning and thinking outside in the fresh air and surrounded by nature, which I love. And then I begin to think about those ideas. And I have to walk by myself now a lot of the time.
Yes.
And I love for you that it's swimming and gardening, and for other authors it's running. But we all need those processes. It's such a good tip.
Yeah. And funnily enough, sometimes I get asked by people when we're doing sort of, you know, workshops and everything, is how do you overcome writer's block? So I always laugh and I always say, I haven't got time for writer's block. You know, I can't have writer's block. But I was thinking, well, it's kind of like being stuck on plot development. That's kind of how I see writer's block. And I always say to myself, just go out and do something mindless. And that will free your mind up, whatever that is, like what you just said, walking, swimming, running, gardening. Yeah.
But sometimes it's just that the answer is there and you need to go and do something else and it will just unclick.
Yeah.
Something will happen.
Yeah.
But you're so right about writer's block. I remember ages ago interviewing Penny Vincenzi, who was a massive, she's sadly passed away now, but she wrote a series of sort of big, it was just slightly in the Jackie Collins vein and sold millions of books, and she said the very same thing. I don't have time for writer's block.
Did she? Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, which is exactly what you said. It really reminded me of that and made me laugh. But those are great tips. Do you have any other tips that you'd like to share for budding writers that have helped you? I think an amazing one, just getting out and getting your hands dirty in the garden or swimming and clearing the mind.
I think you said it in a way, in the fact that don't do something that you think is going to sell or appeal to people. Just do something that kind of makes you feel excited.
And brings you to the page every day, because there's no choice but to write it.
And also, I think for me, it's that love of the characters. So I, you know, having just sort of finished this recent book, you know, like, I love Angie, you know, and I love her siblings and I love her little Bonnie. And there is sort of, you know, there's a love story in the book as well, obviously. And I love all the characters. I just love them. And I don't want to let them go. And that's why I'm really lucky in the fact that they've allowed this to be a trilogy. So I don't have to say goodbye to them. That brings me that excitement when I come to write book two. I'm kind of excited because it's like, oh, okay, so what's going to happen now, you know?
That's so interesting, because that love that you pour into it is reciprocated with the readers, who then love it in turn. So that's why this is working so well for you, isn't it? It's one big love affair.
It is. Well, I mean, I think life, sod money and everything else, life is love, isn't it, of all types.
Oh, that is the perfect note to end on. I've got to say, but before we do, there are three questions that I always ask interviewees. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you if that's right, because again, it's really interesting to compare. But can you recall, or it's very hard to narrow this down, but what your favourite childhood book was?
Oh my God, this is so weird. And I have mentioned this before and it's so peculiar. And I don't think people believe me. So I didn't really read that much as a child, for whatever reason, I don't know. And there was two books that made a huge impact on me. And I must have only been about 10 or 11. And they were Roots.
Roots by Alex Haley. It's massive. It's a blockbuster of a book. I've never heard of it. What's it about?
Oh, so it's basically about, I mean, God knows, in a way, maybe it's because it was so unlike my life. So it's set in America. It's all about sort of slave trade and this family and this generational. Oh, I think they even made a film out of it.
How old were you when you read that book?
I know, it's insane. I must have only been about 11.
But in a way, that's sort of like a saga, isn't it? It's a sweeping intergenerational epic story of love and loss in generations of family. You basically fall in love with the books that you went on to write.
Yeah, do you know what you write? And the other book that I loved and I read a few times was Gone with the Wind.
Again, another sweeping saga.
Yeah, it is. It's, and again, set in America in a time that, you know, probably for me, it was that escapism. But I probably loved it because it was so thick that it was kind of never ending to a certain extent, because it was so long. You know, you just sort of, it was like living in another world, I guess. And oh my God, did I love Gone with the Wind? You know, I watched the film, I read the book again and again.
But isn't that why we read? Because we're not just buying a book, we're accessing a new world.
Yes, yes.
Just a child is really compelling when you can't, you know, you can only cycle up and down your own street. Suddenly it took you to America. Amazing.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, maybe it's on a slightly more sort of more serious note is that, you know, say for a lot of children who, you know, aren't in particularly happy home scenarios, that it gives them that sort of respite and that relief from it, which I think is invaluable.
Yeah, I think a book is a time machine. It just takes us places. It takes us out of our own life and sort of presses pause, yeah, sometimes on the lonely churn of our own thoughts or whatever issues we're facing in life. It's just it's an escape valve, isn't it?
Yes, definitely.
Did you go to the library much growing up?
Oh my God, yes, because it's really funny because obviously I know your love of the library, and sometimes I can't always do talks that I'm asked to do, but I will always, and just, you know, do library talks because I feel so, so passionate. Gosh, so yes, I did used to go to the library a lot during my sort of childhood and growing up. And it was a place of sanctuary. And I distinctly, there were two main libraries that I went to when I was younger. I went to the which was wonderful because I did a talk, one of my first talks I did there actually, and at Sunderland Library. So the library in Sunderland was the museum and the library at that time in this wonderful old building. So as a child, I always remember sort of going in and, you know, the smell of it in the wood and the books. And I just used to sort of, I don't know if I did a lot of reading, to be honest. I just remember sitting at these sort of, you know, those old wooden polished sort of, you know.
I can smell it. As you're talking about it, I can smell it.
And sort of, you know, I sort of look at other people, be more kind of fascinated by it. And it was all, you know, obviously very, very quiet and very serious and peaceful. And then I used to just sort of look up stuff, I guess. Maybe, I don't know, for what it was, school or whatever. I used to be quite interested in doing sort of little tests where you had to find out stuff. And also the museum at that time, you went up stairs and there was galleries, art galleries. So then I would wander around and look at these wonderful sort of thickly layered oil paintings of ships, usually, because obviously it was Sunderland, and storms. And then there was this little cafeteria that sort of ice burned. So it was just such a experience for me. And my mum used to take me there a lot. So also, and I used to go with my sister. So there was the three of us, which I was always very happy when us three were together.
That's such a little nostalgic insight, isn't it? You know, wandering this forest of books, the ice bun treat at the end of it.
And I used to go on my own as well. And I think, again, that's why I think they're so invaluable for children, again, who perhaps need to escape a home life where they just need to be somewhere safe, somewhere quiet, somewhere peaceful, somewhere they can escape in their head. It's multifaceted, the libraries. Libraries to me are not just about books.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree more. You know, they are more than just a repository of books. They are, you know, cradle to grave social welfare, really, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it's interesting as you're talking as well that I heard this saying that libraries make writers. And I definitely feel that coming through in your case.
Yes, yes. Definitely. Oh, definitely. Yes, in for so many reasons, yes.
And Nancy, the final question, if you were sent off to a desert island with only one book, what would it be?
Oh, my goodness. It's funny, actually, I've just been listening to Radio 4 and they've had just from Sunderland. Yeah,
I've nicked it from Desert Island Discs.
Oh, no, don't blame. Oh, gosh. Now, do you know what? Because they give you the Bible free, don't they?
Yes.
So I suppose that would be okay. But I do love the Bible. And that's the other book, funnily enough, that I read a lot when I was young. I
mean, really?
I know.
That's unusual.
Yes, it is.
What did you get out of it?
Well, and do you know what? I must have started reading this before we said, because I remember we were in the house before we moved. And I moved, that's when I was 10, we moved and we were still in the old house. And I remember because we had bunk beds. My sister obviously had the top one. And I remember I must have been given this sort of child's Bible and a nice picture on the front. So it wasn't all stuffy. And I remember opening the first page. And I was reading it as if you would read a book, you know, the first page. And Genesis, which I had no idea what Genesis meant. And just starting to read a story, you know. So for me, the Bible was always about stories. And I think that's where my love has come.
That's so interesting. I never think of the Bible as being stories, but I suppose that's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. And I went on to study, and as I say, totally, you know, non-religious background or anything like that. I didn't go to church or anything like that. And I went on because I found it so fascinating. So I did it for O-level. So I did RE for O-level. And as I say, probably the most, you know, unreligious person I was in the year. And then I went on to do it as A level, and then I got accepted to study theology at Durham University.
So, did you?
Yeah, I didn't go, but I think it was because my love of religious studies came through, and I did really well in it. But what I loved about it, when I look back now, was these wonderful stories that had such great meaning, and they had such messages.
God, this is just, you really blown me away with that, that you went on to, you could have studied theology at Durham University. That's a real sliding doors moment. You could have gone on to be a vicar or a best-selling novelist. Yes. And that's where your life diverged at that point, and you took the stories as your inspiration and went on to follow the career path you have.
Yeah.
That is so interesting.
Oh, it's funny, actually, that it's just through talking to you that I suddenly kind of remembered that. Oh.
God, Nancy, I could talk to you all day. It's just,
I could talk to you all day. And I feel like...
I'm aware that you've got another book to write.
Oh, I know, I know.
Thank you so much for your time, Nancy. It's just been so fascinating. And I can't wait for new book. When is it out?
So it's out in beginning of January.
Oh, beginning of January.
Well, thank you for having me. And I've really enjoyed this.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.